most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It's Tuesday, August 21st. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us today at Normal to help end senseless marijuana prohibition in America. Join us today at norml.org. Prohibition is 70 years old, folks. It won't end without your support. So make your donation or join Normal today. Tuesdays here on the Audio Stash, we have our Government at Work segment. And today we'll be joined by Jennifer Shaw of the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington to talk about the amount patients may possess of medical cannabis for a 60-day supply. There was no original definition of amount in the 10-year-old Washington State medical marijuana law, and that has led to complications. So more on that today with Jennifer Shaw of the ACLU of Washington in our Government at Work segment. Also today, we'll be speaking with Professor Harry Levine from Queens College, City University of New York. Professor Levine wrote an extensive article in July regarding the arrest statistics in New York City regarding marijuana arrests. His data is very compelling, and it shows clear disparity, racial disparity, in the amount of arrests taking place. New York City, by the way, arrests more citizens for marijuana violations than any other city in the country. So Professor Harry Levine, later on today, will be continuing our discussion with Professor Levine in tomorrow's Audio Stash as well. First up today, we have important news from Normal. Our news today. Prescription pain medication use doubles, could be alleviated by cannabis. The use of prescription pain medication by Americans has nearly doubled in the last 10 years, promoting calls to allow wider access to medical cannabis for pain management. In a detailed investigation released this week by the Associated Press and carried in most mainstream media outlets, the AP reports that their analysis of DEA data showed the amount of five main painkillers, codeine, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and meperidine, purchased at retail locations, rose 90% between 1997 and 2005. The drugs marketed under the names Vicodin and OxyContin saw the most dramatic increases in use. Some areas, such as Seattle, Washington, and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, saw the most striking local increases in use, with OxyContin prescriptions rising 160% in Myrtle Beach. The Associated Press cited the following reasons in their investigation for the increases: an aging population with more medical complications, aggressive drug marketing campaigns by pharmaceutical manufacturers, and a change in pain management philosophy by doctors. In regards to the familiar marketing of drugs in America today, the Associated Press report states, quote, "Drug makers have embarked on unprecedented marketing campaigns. Spending on drug marketing has gone from $11 billion in 1997 to nearly $30 billion in 2005, congressional investigators found. Profit margins among the leading companies routinely have been 3 and 4 times higher than in other Fortune 500 industries." Close quote. In the last decade, doctors have been more willing to prescribe narcotic medications for pain and see pain management as an important factor in healing. Yet, because of abuse of painkillers and an overwillingness by some physicians to prescribe them, there has recently been an unfortunate backlash. Fearful of federal prosecution for overprescribing the drugs, some pain management specialists and doctors refuse to prescribe any pain medication even to the sickest patients. Codeine, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and meperidine are also toxic and can pose serious health detriments to those who use them for extended periods of time or in high doses. Accidental overdose is also a serious problem with these drugs. The DEA reported that emergency room visits for these prescription painkillers rose 160%. The report of such widespread use of prescription narcotic painkillers prompted calls for broader access to medical cannabis, which has been proven in dozens of scientific studies in recent years to deal effectively with pain. In many states that allow legal access to medical marijuana, chronic pain or pain associated with a variety of medical conditions allows patients to qualify for marijuana. Many studies also report that medical marijuana is more effective for certain conditions, such as neuropathy, than pharmaceutical painkillers. Marijuana and its active cannabinoids are non-toxic and incapable of causing a lethal overdose, accidental or otherwise. Not a single death from marijuana overdose has ever been recorded, while deaths related to oxycodone overdose alone were almost 400 annually. Perhaps the largest difference between cannabis for pain versus drugs like OxyContin is that cannabis use only shows signs of mild dependence in 1 out of 10 regular users, while OxyContin is considered to be extremely addictive. A federal judge in Virginia recently ordered OxyContin producer Purdue Pharma LP and 3 of its executives to pay a $634.5 million fine for misleading the public about the painkiller's risk of addiction. Finally, there is the simple cost. Drug makers charge from $2 to $6 per pill, depending on the dose, for OxyContin. That could tally up to $300 to $500 per month for those prescribed the drug. U.S. retail sales of OxyContin from 2002 to 2004 alone were $4.7 billion. In comparison, pain management with medical cannabis could cost as little as $40 per month. And in the cases where patients are part of programs such as the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in California or Oregon's Medical Cannabis Program, the cost could literally be no more than the annual registration fee with the state. With America's population aging and the realization that pain relief improves a patient's condition as well as their general well-being, greater access and improved cultivation of medical cannabis could offer a much healthier, more affordable, non-addictive pain management solution. Next up today, it's time for our Government at Work weekly segment, where we look at different state legislative happenings around the country. This week, we look at Washington State. Government at Work today, we're taking a look at some interesting activity taking place around Washington State's medical marijuana program. At issue is the amount of marijuana patients and caregivers may possess, which was never defined under the original law. Joining us today to discuss the issue is the legislative director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington, Jennifer Shaw. Jennifer, welcome back to the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Great to speak with you today, Jennifer. Tell us about what's happening there in Washington. I know there is a series of meetings for public comment coming up to help define what a 60-day supply of medical cannabis is for patients.
That's right. We had the changes to the statute that were passed this past session, and one of the changes was a direction to the Department of Health to create a definition of the 60-day supply. Our law currently doesn't have that definition, and it's caused problems around the state for patients who get harassed by police. Each agency comes up with their own definition. So Department of Health has started a process of creating that rule, and they're thankfully starting it by having stakeholder meetings throughout the state.
I know that different counties, even different towns and city police departments, dictate what they consider to be a supply, but have there been any particular cases that come to mind because of this lack of statewide amount definitions?
Well, we have the range is in some parts of the state, like Yakima, where the chief of police has said that no medical marijuana can ever be possessed legally, to areas in Seattle and King County where there are very few prosecutions for medical marijuana possession because the law enforcement and the prosecutors have decided it's not really something that they want to focus on. And then there's everything in between. So a patient who moves from one place to another just doesn't know what to expect from each law enforcement agency.
And once this public comment period is over and these amounts are defined, will all of the police departments in the state then comply?
That's the benefit of having this, so long as we get a rule that is a meaningful rule and actually defines it in a way that patients can comply with. We're looking at Oregon's model as at least a starting point. Oregon fairly recently increased the amount the patients can possess as a 60-day supply. It's 24 plants, six mature plants, and six of those would be mature plants, and then up to 24 ounces of usable marijuana. And because we're bordering with Oregon, we think that would be an appropriate rule to have for the state of Washington. And if that's implemented, if the Department of Health says the amount possessed in Oregon is the amount that a patient in Washington can possess as a 60-day supply, then a patient can't be arrested if they possess that amount. And they have all of the documentation that they need to prove that they're a medical marijuana patient.
And Jennifer, why is a 60-day supply so important to this definition, as opposed to a 14-day or a 30-day supply of medicine?
Well, that was in our original initiative, and I think that's used in many of the states in their laws. The idea is that you don't want patients to have to constantly go out and try to find sources of marijuana. If they're growing for themselves, then they need to have enough plants growing and enough time to cultivate. If they're having to get someone else to grow it for them or provide it to them, then you don't want them to have to do that every couple of weeks. You want them to be able to possess enough to keep them well for an extended period of time. And when you think about other kinds of prescription medications, you usually get, for chronic conditions, you'll usually get a month or a couple months supply.
Now, how has the patient community responded to this effort to get the supply definitions in place?
Well, I think that there are a wide variety of opinions. I think there are some people that are concerned that the state is going to make it too narrow and have it be an amount that just isn't practical, one plant, three plants, half an ounce, something like that. I think there are other people that see this as an opportunity to continue the discussion in the public eye about sick people needing marijuana to make them well or to keep them functioning. And I'm very hopeful that a lot of people will participate in this public comment period. There are workshops across the state in Seattle, Spokane, Yakima, and Vancouver. And there's also an opportunity to comment through the Department of Health's website. So I really do hope that people who are directly affected by this law will participate and have their voices heard.
And unlike other states, there is no patient registry in Washington for the medical cannabis program.
Right. We're concerned because in some states, and in California and other places, there has been a real, I think, a valid worry that those registries would be used for purposes of law enforcement, sharing that information with the feds and having patients harassed. So we have opposed patient registries in the state.
And, you know, what's the process for this? How soon could these defined amounts come into place?
The bill that just passed requires that the rule process be completed by July 1st of 2008. And so we hope that they'll be done by then. It's a lot of work to be done. After the public comment period, the Department of Health staff will draft what they call a proposed rule, and the public will have an opportunity to comment on that actual draft, and then there will likely be hearings, actual public hearings before the Department of Health, where the patients and others can appear at those hearings and comment on the rule in person. So there's a lot of opportunity for public input on this.
And Jennifer, what happens to patients between now and when the definition of amounts does go into effect? Will those amounts be applied retroactively to arrests, perhaps?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer to it. I would hope that law enforcement would not try to rush to have maximum law enforcement action before the rule goes into place. But as we've seen in some parts of the state, there isn't a whole lot of respect for medical marijuana patients right now. So I can't really tell you exactly what the outcome will be, but I would certainly, if I were litigating, I would certainly make an argument to the judge that, this rule should be the rule that we all operate under.
And Jennifer, you're there at the ACLU in Washington. I know many medical marijuana patients and caregivers have worked with the ACLU offices and sought the advice or legal support of ACLU in different cases. But, you know, because more and more states have now allowed legal access to medical cannabis, is this issue perhaps, I hate to say, even more of a civil rights issue than it was before?
We have looked at the government's drug policy as a civil liberties issue because people are being prosecuted and incarcerated for things that they do to their own bodies. And we think that that's a privacy issue that, you know, you should have a right to do to yourself what you want to do so long as it's not harming someone else. So that's our starting point in terms of the civil liberties issue. With the medical marijuana, we think it's even more egregious because you have pharmaceuticals that are far more harmful that can be prescribed, like OxyContin or opiates. And yet marijuana, because it's listed as a Schedule I drug, can't be prescribed, even though there are people out there who are fully aware of the fact that it helps them with their medical conditions. So, you know, it's just that inconsistency, the government trying to say you can be completely incapacitated by using OxyContin, but you can't use medical marijuana that will help you continue to function. And that just seems to be a misguided use of our public resources.
Righto. Jennifer, I want to thank you again for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. It really was a great conversation here today, and I look forward to checking in with you again on this case.
It's an exciting time. It really is to have this out in the public eye and to have so many people interested in it. We're thrilled.
Jennifer Shaw is the legislative director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington. We have links to their website up at normalaudiostash.com. We also have links to a website that gives everyone the opportunity to have a public comment. If you're a resident of Washington or a medical marijuana patient there, make sure you get your voice heard and attend one of these public comment sessions. We have links to all that information right up on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. And you can also contact the ACLU of Washington directly with links we have at normalaudiostash.com as well.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
New York City arrests more citizens for marijuana violations than any other city in the U.S., perhaps more than any other city on the planet, and more than some whole states. Sociologist Harry G. Levine of Queens College of New York dug deep to find the data associated with these arrests and published his analysis of them in a recent article, The Marijuana Arrest Epidemic in New York City, 1997 to 2006. Levine was interviewed by Newsday based on the article and also testified before the New York State Legislature when they considered a medical marijuana law this summer. Professor Levine joined us by phone to discuss the data. Professor Harry G. Levine, welcome here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks again for joining us today, Professor. Now, what brought all this to your attention? Why did you decide to study this arrest data in New York City?
Actually, it was brought to my attention by my dear friend and colleague, Lynn Zimmer, sociologist at the University of New York and the co-author of the book Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, A Review of the Scientific Evidence, which is a terrific, essential work on this stuff. And Lynn, in the late 1990s, knew about this, what was going on. She was really a longtime criminologist, a serious student of prisons and policing, and she first brought it to my attention at that time. There was some normal data, I think it's important to note that stuff that Normal had brought out in the late 1990s, work done by John Getman, showed some used FBI data to show some of what was going on in various places, and that New York's marijuana possession arrests had skyrocketed or begun, really, to rise dramatically beginning around 1996, jumped in 97, again in 98 and 99. It was about that time. It was all that really I knew at that point and that all that that Lynn knew at that point.
Now, Professor, before 1996, the amount of marijuana arrests in New York City wasn't really that high. But what happened in 1997 that really made these numbers begin to skyrocket?
Rudolph Giuliani became mayor of New York in 93, but really didn't get seriously focusing on changing policing patterns until a couple of years into it. And he really focused on making many minor misdemeanor arrests, just arresting lots and lots of people. And the marijuana arrests were actually part of this much larger sweep of Giuliani's of making many marijuana arrests. The interesting thing is that, two interesting things. One is that hardly anybody knew about the marijuana arrests. There was virtually no coverage of it. There was a couple of articles in about 97 or 98, and then it basically stopped. The police don't talk about it. They don't stand in front of charts showing their rising number of marijuana arrests. And when they talked about the minor arrests, which is also used, described under the name broken windows policing or quality of life policing, they focused on other things. They focused on people drinking in the street or turnstile jumpers or people urinating in public, but not marijuana arrests. For a reason that it took me a long time to understand and figure out and only really learned from interviewing lots of cops and also people arrested for marijuana, which is that by and large people arrested in New York are not arrested for smoking. They're arrested simply for having it in their pocket, which is not really a quality of life crime, and the police are actually not eager to call attention to that. So they have sort of carried on under the radar from through Giuliani's term, which ends in the end of 2001. Michael Bloomberg becomes mayor in 2002. Many people think he is a less conservative and less repressive a character Giuliani is, but the truth is that the marijuana arrests have continued at the very high levels under Bloomberg, as have lots of other misdemeanor arrests, they are as high as they were before. Bloomberg's average, yearly average of marijuana arrests is higher than Giuliani's average years of marijuana arrests. In the last year, 2006, we're in 2007 right now, 2006, New York City arrested over 33,000 people for possessing small amounts of marijuana, and most of them spent a night in jail. The racial disparities, which have been central and important part of what's been going on here, 85% of the people arrested in New York City are either black or Latino. The racial disparities is higher in 2006 than in any other year.
And along with the racial disparity, you also uncovered an even more striking gender disparity to the marijuana arrests there in New York City. Harry, tell us this number. I'd like to have you explore it a bit.
Yeah, this pattern, I'm not quite sure whether it's true nationally or not, but it's certainly true in New York, and I think it's probably true in lots of places. 91% of the people arrested for possessing marijuana in New York City are male. Nearly all of them are under 30 years of age. Not all of them, but the vast majority. In fact, the majority are probably under 26. And they are men. Why the New York City Police Department is doing all these things is a complicated story, and that's part of what I've been researching really seriously for the last year and a half or so. The male bias in the rest is actually one of the easier ones to understand, which is that several factors. One is there are far more male cops than female cops. And there are rules, informal ones and even formal ones, about handling arrestees and suspects. And the cross-gender stuff is the one about which everybody feels the most squeamish. And so there are things that men are not allowed to do with female arrestees. Females are not allowed to do with male arrestees, including certain kinds of searches. And the whole court and jail system in New York is geared to men. So the prison cells are geared to hold many more men, the whole guard structure and everything. So that the cops prefer to arrest guys, and as the cops say, that there's a kind of a chivalry thing in that too. It's that they just don't want to, they don't want to bust the women if they possibly can.
Professor, you've been speaking to a lot of law enforcement personnel, mainly those who are retired, but nonetheless, they were out there on the street conducting these arrests. You know, Harry, this epidemic of minor marijuana possession arrests, do you think it has become an entrenched part of police culture there in New York City at this point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Giuliani and his police commander sought to make it and all kinds of this sort of low-level misdemeanor arrests part of the police culture, to change the police culture. They talked about trying to change the police culture. And from the cops that I have interviewed, including people who were on the force, say, began on the force in the early 1980s, and so spent 10 or so years under one sort of regime and style of policing, an older one and a more common one, talk about how dramatic that change was, and that in the 1980s, if a police officer had arrested somebody for having a small amount of marijuana, a joint in their pocket or a nickel bag or something, they would bring the arrestee into the police station in handcuffs generally, and that arrestee would be accepted, and the desk sergeant or so on would process it, but they might ridicule or tease the guy. Hey, look at what John's brought in. Really dangerous marijuana user. Whoa, really bad. By about the early mid-90s, 96, 97, maybe even as early as 95, that begins to change. The ridicule drops out. And then people are even encouraged to do it. Hey, I want to see the rest of you going out and doing what Jones is doing. You know, the collars are out there, go out and make them. So the command structure, the norms about policing, the explicit, you know, sort of what the explicit guidelines and what they're encouraged to do change quite dramatically and quite visibly, and what formerly had been regarded as openly worthy of ridicule, became openly worthy of praise.
And Professor Levine, in regards to this racial disparity, I've encountered many law enforcement personnel, some from New York City, and in fact, the ones I've encountered are certainly not racist in their individual lives. But how is it that on one hand, these police officers are seeking out peaceful marijuana smokers to arrest, but the ones they do arrest tend to be black and Hispanic, tend to be so by 85%. How is this happening? It's certainly not as if white people in New York City aren't smoking pot.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. It's very important to understand that every national study and every study of high school students that's ever been done finds that whites use marijuana more often than do blacks and Latinos, sometimes quite dramatically so. That's true whether they've used it in their lifetime and they used it in the last year, the last month, or even daily use. It's true for young teenagers. It's true for whites and blacks and Latinos between 18 and 25, and it's true for high school seniors. Whites use marijuana more than blacks and Latinos, but blacks and Latinos get arrested everywhere in America, just about, more than whites. And New York is a sort of huge example of that and case of that. Now, why that goes on in all kinds of different places is complicated. But I guess one simple way of understanding it is the police fish in only certain waters. They don't tend to go after making stop, frisk, and search people arrests, by and large, in white, wealthy, and especially in suburban counties. The places in America, and the places in New York City, for that matter, that have the lowest levels of marijuana arrests tend to be white and wealthy, and outside of New York City, they tend to be suburban. So they're places like Fairfield, Connecticut, and Fairfax, Virginia, and Contra Costa County, and any place you've got a large, wealthy, white, suburban county, there aren't going to be very many marijuana arrests of anybody at all. On the other hand, the police are concentrated in all kinds of places, tend to be concentrated in poorer neighborhoods, in working-class neighborhoods, which also tend to be, especially in cities in the United States, disproportionately racial minorities, black, Latino, in the Southwest, they may be Native Americans, and that's where the police focus lots of their attention and energy, is where they stop people, where they stop them and frisk them, and where they will search them or the cars in some cases, looking for anything that they can find, any kind of contraband, as the police would put it, that can make a collar that could allow them to bring somebody into the station house and get credit for having made an arrest. And police want credits for having made arrests. Their promotions and their status within the force depends upon how, quote, productive they are, and productivity is measured above all and first of all by the number of arrests they make. So they're sent out to focus especially in certain neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods tend to be disproportionately or even overwhelmingly black and Latino neighborhoods, racial minorities, and then the people that, as best as anybody's been able to figure out, then the people that they stop and search are in even in white neighborhoods are more likely to be blacks and Latinos, and in black neighborhoods they're more likely to be blacks and Latinos. So everywhere they go, they're sort of searching for likely suspects. One of the interesting things about, and I absolutely agree with you that the cops are, and we're not, I mean, cops, in, especially in New York, don't seem to be motivated by racial bias, and there seems to be a wish, I suspect, at the top levels of the police department, which they could, if they could just get a whole bunch of poor whites somehow in New York, if some part of poor white Appalachia could somehow be now officially part of New York City, they would really love to go after, you know, trailer park trash or something like that to be able to get it. But we don't have a lot of that in New York City or in other major cities in New York. Middle class, upper middle class white people tend to have political connections. They may know somebody or be related to somebody who knows somebody who can make a fuss, who can embarrass, make trouble for the arresting officer and his commanders. And nobody wants a complaint or noise or some prominent politician saying, why the hell is this kid brought in and what is this such a big deal about? Poor people of any color are much less likely to have such connections. So going after racial minorities, especially people in poorer neighborhoods, is less likely to get you, the resting cop, in trouble. So again, their sort of whole policing mechanism is geared to not creating a ruckus in terms of public publicity or public relations or some kind of prominent person. So again, the focus tends to be on the least politically connected people to arrest.
We've been speaking with Professor Harry G. Levine from Queens College in New York City, the City University of New York, about his recent article, The Marijuana Arrest Epidemic in New York City, 1997 to 2006. We have links to read the complete article on our website at normalaudiostash.com. We'll hear the rest of this interview in tomorrow's Audio Stash. Make sure you tune in every day. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.